Cleanse them. Cleanse the world of their ignorance and sin. Bathe them in the crimson of... Am I on speakerphone?
No, absolutely not.
Hi, I'm Robert Lendrum.
And my name is Jamie Roberts.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the movies that had you running away but coming back for more.
Jamie, how are you? Good to see you, buddy. Good to talk to you. I feel like we haven't potted in like 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, it's been a while. You know, we've had the finish to the holidays. We've had the, you know, it was like the precursor to school coming back. And then we had Snowmageddon that came in on the Monday. But it feels like it's been longer, but I think it's only been maybe, I don't know, what was the last thing we did? We did Terrifying Tracks. We did on the Friday. Yeah, it's probably been 2 weeks. So it's a little bit longer for us to go. But you know what? The streets are cleared. The plows are working.
Maybe
the
your kids street.
The kids are back in school.
I live on a dead end, and it's like an island. No one came to save us. Like, they did not plow our street. In fact, they just like blocked off the end. They had to bring a bobcat the next day to take down the block. And we were like, "Hello, like, we live here. We have to get out." Anyway, Hamilton was hit by a huge snowstorm, and I guess you guys on the west side got plowed. The plows came real quick, eh? But not over here.
Oh, yeah, man. We got heated streets out here, man. We need the plow.
Yeah, no, it's not like that on my side of town.
No, but it was
nice to see everybody out there shoveling, though. Like, it's kind of a community feeling when you got like six people on the block just like out there shoveling at the same time.
Absolutely. Everybody gets out. You've got, you know, Joanne across the street with her two terriers. She comes out. She's like, "Oh, a lot of snow." And you got Johnny across the street, myself. Everyone brings their kids out. The shovels are flying. You know, I've got some older people on my street, so everybody pitches in, clears the walk. Absolutely is a community thing. Feels good. And on top of that, what was also great is not only were schools canceled on the Monday when all the snow fell.
Like, oh, yeah, great for
just
you.
Hit. Exactly.
Fucking teacher.
Everybody knows I'm a teacher, part-time worker. No, I'm just kidding. For all the teachers out there. We had the Tuesday off because there was a lot of snow clearing that needed to happen. And, you know, we live in Hamilton, but it's around Toronto, and the full GTA was shut down for Tuesday. So we had an extra day, had a little skating party, went tobogganing down at the golf course. So it was good.
Oh, my God, at the golf course. Me and Reginald went to bargain.
I tell you, I don't know what it is about this big winning streak I'm on. I'm in the zone. What can I say? The hole just seems to get bigger. Excuse me, I got to go play a little golf.
It's a public golf course, man. It's like right down the street. You can walk there.
See, you guys had the day off. You could take your kids out. Me and my wife had to sit at home and work with our two kids home, just like playing with matches, like burning down the house. Like, it was chaos trying to function. Because I probably should have just taken the day off, but like, I just started a new job. So to be like, "Hey boss, I'm just going to take the day off today. It's snowy out, you know, can't work," even though I work from home.
Well, you know what, man, speaking about kids, I got to tell you something exciting. So my sister had her second child. She had a baby.
Oh, congratulations, Alex and Rob. That's her husband's name, right?
Yeah. Rob, he's in our fantasy pool. He's doing well. Tarps off. Little Matthew. So now we got little Willie, we got little Matthew, we got Robbie and Alex. So they're very excited, happy, healthy boy, about, I think, 7 pounds, 13 ounces.
Is that a turkey or a baby? It's a baby. That's a good size baby.
Yeah, it is, but isn't it, huh?
Small turkey, though.
Very exciting, but like sad because of the restrictions with COVID. We couldn't get to the hospital. Mm-hmm. It was only, you know, it wasn't even close family. It was just Rob that was in there, but happy and healthy and doing great. So really happy for my sister. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
it was amazing. Uncle Jamie.
Yeah, and then how's it been back with kids going to school? You got Fox back in class. How's it feeling?
Oh, man, so good to have him back. It's so good to have him back in school for my sake. Now, but I think he's happier too. You know, he's just got more to do and he's not so bored and he's, you know, actually learning and, you know, he's just a little more exhausted at the end of the day, which is nice, instead of still being all wound up and finally getting his time with his parents that he's been waiting for all day because he's waiting for us to finish work. I'll tell you, this school from home thing, the virtual week was, I got to say, this Hamilton teacher was a lot better than what we had in Toronto, but still, it's not great. It's not great stuff.
Well, if I remember, you guys were on Clifford Overload, right?
Oh, my God. Last year, the guy in Toronto, every day a new Clifford book. I thought this guy was in the pocket of Deep Red, man. Like, Scholastic is just, like, sliding a check to him every week. Like, keep those Clifford books going, buddy. If you want to see another one of these, read another Clifford. Clifford movie coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot out there. There's a lot of other resources we can do.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to be back and teaching. And then got through the week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all done. Ready to hit the weekend.
Yeah, and ready to pod. And tonight we were supposed to do Train to Busan. We are still doing that. So don't worry, fans out there. We will be doing that soon. One of the reasons we delayed it is we wanted to get a little more context from someone who could help us with it. Because we felt like two white dudes from Hamilton trying to talk about Korea. And there's so much about that culture that's like prevalent in that film. Like they're really doing a social commentary about South Korea. So we have enlisted someone who's going to really help us, and we'll talk about that. Well, you'll see on the next pod when we do Train to Busan. So that one is still coming. So we decided just to fill the hole with a review this week of another fun one, Cabin in the Woods from 2012.
Oh, but quickly, really quickly. You talked about the Train to Busan, and we're bringing on the reporter from the South Korea Times to help us out with that. It's going to be super exciting. We just got a sneak peek of the Jogcast that's going to come in. This is part three. Yeah, this is part three of Blood at Night. This is, I'm just going to come out and say it. This is fucking epic.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot wait to hear this. You're going to love it. We're loving it. I'm in awe of what, big shout out, big meow to Jason Kerr, Big Cat Media. This guy's going to be divorced within the month. Like, he's putting in so much time. He's putting in so much time on our Jogcast, and he's working full time. This guy's a trooper. Jason Kerr doing amazing work. It should be out within the week. Fingers crossed. Hopefully sooner. You're going to love it.
And this is part three, so we'll bundle it into a full length for the Patreon. And Jamie will probably link it to the main shit feed. On Patreon. Jamie will definitely leak it back to the main feed. So look forward to that. That'll give you about 50 minutes, we think, in total for a jog. If you want the full length, or you can break it down to the three parters. All right. So let's get started with The Cabin in the Woods.
The director is Drew Goddard. And this guy was a writer for, you know, the really... And you know, it's funny. I didn't get into it, but the TV show Lost, you know, was really popular. Rob, did you ever get into that show?
So I decided to abstain from Lost until... Because I think when it really started to get a lot of buzz.
This sounds serious.
Yeah. No, and it got all that buzz. People were telling me like, you should watch Lost. I'm like, what season is that? And they're like, six, and it's going to end with seven. I'm like, okay, then I'll wait till seven comes out. And if seven's good, maybe I'll watch it. And I don't know if you know this, because if you're not a fan either, but a lot of people hated the conclusion to this show. And I was just like, do I want to invest in this show now? Like, I know people liked it, or like it was fun to be on the ride with them. But the ending apparently really, you know, pushed, like made a lot of people upset, or just sort of was not satisfying. And it just made me think like, man, I don't know if I want to invest in seven seasons just to get to a non-satisfying ending. So I never picked it up.
I felt like it was polarizing. I wasn't a fan. Well, not a fan. I didn't watch it. I didn't get into it. You know, I wanted to, but I don't know. I just never did. But I know it was polarizing, similar to like a Twin Peaks kind of show, right? Like it had a very ardent, faithful fan base. And I heard the same thing, when the ending came. It was not well received, similar to like a Sopranos ending, right? That's just kind of, it's going to make some people happy, but most unhappy. Anyways, he was a writer on Lost. He was also a writer on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So he's, you know, I think he comes from a little bit of, I wouldn't say horror, but, you know, thriller.
Yeah.
Some clever writing. So anyways, he...
That's Joss Whedon. And did Joss Whedon not produce this film? Or was he not?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, okay, I thought so.
He did as well. So, Rob, I think we just start with like some opening thoughts on this film, because this is like a horror comedy, and it comes in an hour and 35 minutes. And, you know, we talk off pod about how there's a lot of subversion in this film. But do you have any opening thoughts about it that you want to share?
No, let's dive in. But one thing we should talk about is we're going to kill our 60-second plot challenge, which you and I have been failing at amazingly.
What are you talking about? You're great at it, man. I'm the one that's like bad.
Well, you found out from some listening that a couple other pods have been doing the same kind of shtick. Do you remember who they were?
Yeah, there's the second pod eludes me right now, but I definitely want to shout out Shaken Not Scared. They've been doing the 60-second pod or the 60-second challenge for a while, so you know what I mean. I want to shout them out. Just say, you know, we're not stepping on any toes. We're gonna kill it. You guys do a great job.
I want to know who came up with it. Them or the other pod? Since they need to go. Yeah. They should have a beef war with each other.
We're warriors, man. When we go into battle, we come out. I don't come out at all.
See who can get to own it.
Anyway. Yeah, so we're all about exactly. We're about originalism here, right? So we're just gonna kind of focus on that.
Is that a word? Anyway, yeah, we are totally.
Yeah, what are we talking about? Originalism. Originalism. Yeah, that's a word, man.
Is it? Okay. Well, we will come up with a new way of doing our plot summary.
Anybody that does any kind of research onto the film will know that. You know, they thought it was a little bit funny because you don't really know what the movie is about if you first walk in.
No.
And then because the title graphic comes up, Cabin in the Woods, it takes up the whole screen and it's in really thick font, bright red, like blood red. You kind of think you're in the wrong movie, and that's something that they kind of had a little bit of fun with, right?
It's a great setup for the movie because you're not getting what you expect. And let's point out the actors here, like Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford. Like these two guys, and by the way, you're a big fan of Bradley Whitford, I'm pretty sure. If you go back to our Anaconda recast, Jamie's
Oliver. Yeah, that guy. Exactly, man.
But these two set up, like they are a great duo for this film. I think these two are like super funny, and they embody these characters so perfectly in the sense that they are almost pulled from a past time, almost like a 50s, but like modernized. But they definitely come from this like type of work environment that and they just – what am I trying to say?
The way they look, the way they talk, like they're working in 1950s NACA or NASA.
That's what I'm getting at. Like there's this old school approach to how they look at work.
100%, right? Which makes you think that the – place in which they work is been around for a long time. There's legacy there. There's history.
What I'm saying is just like you can tell, like you're saying, there is a history. There's a way to do the job. They've been doing it forever. It's the type of job you can probably smoke at because it's like you said, NASA in the 50s. Like I imagined I was going to see ashtrays just overflowing, coffee black in a styrofoam cup. You know, like there's sort of a pro, like you feel like a pro though. Like these two guys are like old pros.
Yeah. And absolutely for sure. Right. So Cabin in the Wood comes and then we've got a cut and we go to scene two. What happens here, Rob? We get introduced to an ensemble cast.
Right. Here comes our ensemble cast. So what did you think about Dana being introduced in her underwear and the weird shaped windows that are like who the fuck dances around in their walks around their room in their underwear when like their windows go as low as their knee. So you can basically see her whole leg. Like I was just like perplexed by this choice because it's weird. It's like, it's all about giving the audience something to look at and telling the audience like, oh, you're in a horror film. You're going to get some legs. You're going to get some, you might get to see some boobies. Like it's totally, it's a little bit of that like teaser titillation stuff, right? This is our main character, Dana, played by Kristen Connolly. And they do a quick thing of her backstory where she's coming off some sort of heartbreak and the heartbreak is from her like professor. So there's like a weird, like, you know, thing going on there where she's a student sleeping with her prof and her friend, Jules comes in, Anna, who's like just dyed her hair blonde. And she's like super kind of fun and flirty and excited and trying to get her pumped up for this weekend at the cabin in the woods. Then we get our like muscle bound hunk, Chris Hemsworth. Is this one of his first films, by the way? Did you check his IMDb on this one?
I didn't, but this definitely like predates all the Thor movies.
Yeah. He's not Thor yet, but he's starting to Thor up. You can tell here. The dude's like been working out.
For sure. But it's funny. Like he is this tall, good looking guy. He's built, he plays football. But he's referred to as like, you know, he's a sociology major, and it's like really funny where he like looks at what she's reading and then he's like, that's not good. You want to check out like this. And he like rhymes off some random, you know, European author. Right. So there, he shows a little bit of depth through his character, which is going to be important later. And then we get Grey's Anatomy guy. We get Holden.
Jesse Williams.
I think it's Jesse Williams. Yes. So this guy rolls up and he's I guess referred to as the scholar. So he's going to start to, he rounds out the four. Right. And I think what the intention is that he's brought along as a setup for Dana, because Dana's getting over, or they want to try to get her over this heartbreak, right?
Yeah.
So then it's like this like idyllic, it feels like they're on a university campus or close to a university campus, like everybody's biking around, it's like good foliage. And then this guy rolls up in his like 1986 Volvo, smoking a bong out of his coffee cup container. And this is Marty. And I love this character. This guy's fantastic.
Yeah. But dude, his coffee mug like extends into a bong, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
Which again, will come back later.
Oh, for sure.
So this dude's hilarious. He's just like, he kind of feels like he's pulled out of like an episode of Friends, except an episode of Friends where they allowed it to become PG-13 or R-rated just so that they could have a pothead. Like totally feels like he's a cartoon character of a pothead. Like the way he's dressed.
Like,
and,
for sure. Like, you know, like Scooby-Doo high. But normally like in horror films, you've got the pothead that is going to get killed, not first, but like pretty quickly. But they don't do anything like in other films, right? They don't do much with that character. But this guy's got some extra face time. You know what I mean? He's got extra lines. You know right away, or at least you feel right away, that he's not going to be your run-of-the-mill kind of pothead that, you know, that's just going to be there for smoking a bong and smiling. Like he's more important to the story. And I think he kind of definitely subverts the horror trope of like the pothead getting killed, you know, sort of early-ish, right? Which I think makes him interesting. So anyways, they're going on this trip to the cabin in the woods. I think it's Kurt's brother or cousin.
It's his cousin.
Yeah, it's his cousin. So
says Kurt.
They go into the RV that they're going to be traveling in, and then the shot sees them pulling away and driving down the road, but then the camera pans up and there is some kind of, Rob, would you say he's like an operative on the roof of...
He's like an agent. I don't know.
Yeah, he's like, he's on the roof of the building and he's like, the nest is empty. So then right away, you know that like, it's not just your typical horror film. So we got a quick scene where it cuts back to the government booth, right? So then you've got Steve and Gary, and what's happening is it looks like there's a new security guard in like their main booth. So at this point of the movie, like we don't even know what's happening. All we know is that we've got these five, young adults that are going to the cabin in the woods, and we have this operative that's saying the nest is empty. And then we keep cutting back. This is the second time now that we've gone back to this like facility, and that looks like they're in a control room. And then now they're talking about to the security guard that seems to be new, you know, being prepped, or they ask him if he's ready. And he says, I've been prepped. And then Steven says, well, being prepped is not being prepared. So there's a little bit of like kind of innuendo there. He's being a little bit cryptic in the way he's speaking.
This character, by the way, like, if you think about it, this character is really like, he's there as a device for them to talk to, because he's the new guy, which makes no sense that there's a new guy on like this on the night that this is happening, because it's like the biggest event of their year. And then he literally does nothing in this movie. Like at the end, he gets a couple shots in and then he gets killed. So this guy is strictly there to sort of be talked to. He's there so that the guys can explain what they're doing and to show how they think about it. And then he is there as like a counter, like his ethics are, he's like morally, he's questioning the morality of this whole thing. And they address him, you know, they talk about that with him. But that's the only reason he's there. He serves no other function.
Is that right? Yeah. And I'm not even sure it's effective, right? Like, you know, as you pointed out, like that, you do see the antithesis to their seemingly like
they're callous, right?
Like mechanical, metallic way of going about what it is we're going to find out they're doing. And then he's there, but I'm not sure it serves any purpose other than from what you just said. We go on and we cut back to the RV and
the gas station.
We've got the proverbial gas station stop.
So can you think of what this reference is? Like what movie have you seen this in before? Well, do they not do it in Friday the 13th? Like before anyone gets to Crystal Lake, they usually stop. And as soon as they mention where they're going, people kind of go like, oh, I wouldn't go there if I were you or whatever.
For sure. The first one, they go into the diner and everybody's like, where are you going? Camp Blood. Like there's definitely the stop in a lot of these films where you talk to some kind of local or some kind of townsfolk that either warns you or is rude to you or pisses you off. You know, this is like straight right from some of the Halloween films, right? Even though Loomis, you know, he's stopping at the gas station. He's not really talking to anybody. There's still that stop at the gas station. It kind of, you know, is meant to propel the story in one way or another.
Yeah, he's like a prophet too, isn't he? Like, it's very common in like tragedy, like Shakespeare, like, or go back to like Greek tragedies. There's always like a prophet who kind of an oracle who, you know, kind of tells you what's coming. And of course, the hero always makes the fault of not listening to them and continues on anyway.
He's referred to as the Harbinger, right? Anyway, so they roll up to this gas station, and this gas station is like, I know it's got a close sign, but like, can they just make it look like the friggin' oldest gas station, like the fucking worst gas station I've ever seen? Like,
this shit's like a pile of mud.
Yeah, like, it's not even like, come on, man. Like, me and you have been, like, Rob over here, for all the listeners, his family had a place up on Crow River. You know what I mean? Up in the Canadian North, and we would go there forever. I've never seen a gas station look as bad.
The Canadian North. You make it sound like it's like in like close to the Arctic.
Okay, this is the Great White North, okay, on the map. Now here is a different color because it's like USA. And up there, same color as Alaska, because that's like Hawaii.
It's a big country, man.
So they meet this guy. This guy's a total asshole to them. Of course, he like gives them all a hard time. He kind of gives them a hard time for even wanting to buy gas. And then he insults them.
I've seen plenty come and go. Well, I've been here since the war.
Which war?
You know damn well which war.
Would that have been with the blue and some in gray, that war?
You sassing me, boy.
You were rude to my friend.
That whore.
What'd you say?
I think we got enough gas.
You got enough to get you there. Getting back, that's your concern.
What's the warning, though? Like, they call him a harbinger, but what does he actually say that scares them about that place, other than it's been flipped many times in terms of ownership?
He didn't really give a warning, but he kind of like plays it off a little bit where, you know, maybe he's not giving it a ringing endorsement. You know what I mean? They come into the gas station, and, you know, if you look up into the top window, you know, there's a Confederate flag.
Well, here's the other thing. Remember, this guy is part of the act that...
No, for exactly. He's the Harbinger. He's Mordecai. He's clearly part of it. He's meant there as like... He's put there as like a sentry to be a warning that's not a warning, because as they sort of move through this elaborate ruse, they need to sort of pass all these like tests, right?
But that's what I don't get about that. Because like you said, he doesn't actually warn them about really anything.
But I don't think he can. I don't think he can.
Yeah, what's the transgression then? Like, it's supposed to be that they decided to keep going, and they made this choice. So they didn't really make a transgression, because they were never like told that this.
I know, but the transgression is like the way this guy looks, the gas station, the creepiness. It's the horror, the whole horror trope of it, right?
No, that's I understand it from a filmmaking point of view, but I'm going by the rules set up in the movie where they say, you know, these guys have to make all the decisions. We just help them along, because they're helping them along to put them into this horror movie situation, right? And what I'm just saying is, like, Mordecai doesn't really present them with anything that makes you say, well, why are we going there? He just says, like, yeah, it's been a lot of owners, and that's, you know, he kind of makes it sound.
Isn't it? But like,
it's not enough to me.
Isn't it?
I don't think so. He doesn't actually say
a warning with
a lot of people died there or something like that. Yeah, cement. Maybe we're arguing over splitting hairs here. So let's move on.
Well, good luck with your business, sir. I know the railroad's coming through here any day now. That's going to be big. Fucker.
Anyways, they ride in, the RV rides in, and one of the cool things and one of the first things you see is, you know, they talk about that in the previous conversation with Mordecai, the gas station attendant, about going through this like rock cave or this rock underpass. And then they, you know, the camera pulls out, the RV goes in the rock underpass and then comes out the other side, and an eagle is flying across this big chasm and flies right into this like big magnetic field. And it reminded me of like the Hunger Games, You know, when you the magnetic field comes and you see like the grid looks like a honeycomb.
Did you feel like this gave it away too quick? Like, I know they're trying to tell us like, oh, they're going to.
So the second time around, for sure. And that's what I talked to you when I texted you, and I was just like, man, I don't know if this movie's like doing it for me the second time around.
So what's going to happen later? Someone's going to die by trying to jump this chasm. They're going to hit this magnetic wall.
Yeah.
Which would have been cool to learn about at that moment. So, but instead we already know. So at the time we're not shocked when it happens because we just saw this eagle have the same thing happen. So I wonder if they debated that in the edit when they said, do you think we should actually let them know this or should we just get like save this for later? But they get to the cabin. It's like a dump. It is a crappy looking dump. It's very kitsch though, I guess you could say, if you like that kind of thing. They go inside. There's like a wolf head on the wall.
I thought it was all right.
Oh, come on, dude. I mean, I've seen some of the cottages you choose with the dude that watches you from inside the jacuzzi with the spy cam. Maybe you want to tell us that story one time. But anyway, this place is...
Oh, you know what? Listen, this has to be addressed right now on pod, right? Like, fuck. Okay, listen.
Wasn't there like a guy with like a small man-child servant that he walked around with?
One year, I'm trying to book a cottage for all my friends. And
this is how this movie starts.
There's like 25 of us. And the fucking... Like, Bob was the guy that had a cottage. It wasn't like ridiculous. We had to drive like almost to Sudbury. Anybody that knows Canada, just Google map that shit. Okay. Look at Hamilton, look at Sudbury. And it was like in the middle of fucking nowhere. And then there was this guy that would come and pick like a summer student, I think it was referred to as. We were the only cottage in. It's not like this guy had like a full.
Was it a house or what was it? Wasn't it like a campground or something?
No, there was no campground. There was no compound. It was our thing. And he would just come get our recycling at 11 o'clock at night. Anyways.
At 11 o'clock at night? Why didn't he come the next morning?
Fuck, you were there, man.
No, I wasn't. I missed this year.
Oh, you missed that?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I wasn't there that year. I didn't go to this one.
Oh, shit. Okay.
I heard there was bunk beds.
Yeah, Tony was all mad that like the sheets were from fucking 1956 and then she asked for a new, I don't know, it was just not a good scene. Anyway, so I booked it and the cottage itself looked a lot like, so this cabin in the woods, listen, this cabin in the woods
is going off the rails.
Didn't look all that dissimilar from your place up in Havelock.
Are you talking about the movie now?
I'm talking about your cottage.
Oh.
They arrive at the cabin and it's interesting, like you look at it from the outs, from just the like the front profile, and it doesn't look very big. But once you go in, like it's just pretty large. There's like a big seating area, and they kind of go into the rooms. And there's like one thing that's creepy is there's a one-way mirror. So Dana,
with a painting of a goat being sacrificed, but the guy moves it, and then he sees into Dana's room.
And Marty comes in and says, you know, like this is. Been here since the turn of the century. He goes, you know, they had to create their own interrogation rooms, which makes you think that the cabin might have been there a lot longer.
I think right? He's joking. Like, I think you're missing the joke there. The joke is like, he's like, yeah, you know, this place has been here so long that, you know, back in those days, you had to make your own interrogation room.
Oh, maybe I am missing
that's it, the joke he's making. Like, is a weird thing to find here.
I was thinking, like, maybe it is like from the that long ago that they actually had, I don't know, but anyways, so they cover it up. And
wait, where's your interrogation room in your house?
Yeah, but this is not 1903. Anyways, so the funny thing is like they switch rooms. So he's like, he wants to look at her taking her shirt off and her bra off, but he's like the good guy, right? He's the scholar. So he plays.
He goes pretty damn close though, doesn't he?
Yeah, man. Cause he walks away and then he kind of like rocks back and he goes, nah. And then he goes back and then it's flipped. So they switch rooms, right? And then
why he immediately pulls his dong out.
He took it out.
Yeah, why?
Just why pulls it out. He's waving it.
Why does he start getting undressed in front of the mirror right after they switch rooms?
Yeah.
Like, this is low-hanging fruit.
This guy knows what's up.
She's looking at it, and she's just like, no. She puts the picture back up, and then she puts a blanket over it and then they kind of go on, right?
So this scene transitions with the surveillance camera. We pull back, we reveal the monitor of Gary and Steve watching the kids in the cabin back at the industrial complex underground. And so now we're starting to realize what's going on. Okay, these guys have set up this cabin. They've set up this whole event. These kids are here at the cabin in the woods. And it, like, now we're starting to get the sense that, like, okay, some shit is about to go down, and they are the ones behind it. And the funny, there's this great scene though where Mordecai calls in and God damn, I can't remember their fucking names.
Steve.
Because they're so generic, those fucking names. It should have been Mike and Bob.
That's why. That's the thing. The generic outfits, the generic names.
So Steve gets a call from Mordecai and he puts on speaker. And Mordecai is just talking in this crazy, like,
he's talking in, like, biblical speak, like, the lambs have come to the slaughter, they've passed through the gates and they're going on to the things, and they
don't take this lightly, boy. It wasn't all by your numbers. The fool nearly derailed the invocation with his insolence. The ancient ones see everything, and they will not be. I'm still on speakerphone, aren't I?
Oh my God, Mordecai!
And we've seen that painting now with the goat getting slaughtered. So, like, we're starting to understand the connection. But it's so funny how serious he takes it. But Steve is totally, like, laughing about it, like how crazy Mordecai is. So he puts him on speaker and they're all just, like, biting their fists, listening to him go off. It's a hilarious scene. But also, I love how it shows you the character of Gary and Steve, how they, like, they've been doing this forever. They're pros. And so they know how to take the piss out of their friends and out of each other.
Are they a little complacent? Are they too comfortable in it? Like, because, I think that's what Wendy picks up. Amy Acker, you know.
Right,
Amy
but she's Acker's also kind character. Of the noob compared to them, right? Like, she's had the job for, like, a couple of years, but they've been doing it for, you know, 30 or whatever.
That scene finishes, and then we get the proverbial, this is straight out of a horror 101 manual. We get the lake scene, Rob. We get the swim scene. And I love, this is, you know, Chris Hemsworth, why he's become so popular and so famous is not only is he a good-looking guy, looks like Thor. Mm. He's a likable dude, right?
Yeah,
like,
that is a good point about his character, is that you expect him to be the jockhead, and he never steps over that line of being a douche. Like, he's always actually pretty nice, and, like, every time he opens his mouth, you think he's going to do something super douchey. And
the drugs start to get into him, right?
Right, but then it's pointed out to you too, right?
Yeah, happens.
So, like, it's interesting how they created a character with, and again, your expectations are set up to be like, oh, he's that guy, and he isn't that guy. And that's something that's going to keep happening in this movie. In fact, everything, for example, going back to Mordecai calling in and being the harbinger, he's actually, in a way, if you think about who the victims are in this movie and reverse it, that it's actually Steve and Gary and the whole crew back at the compound. This is the first sign for them that things aren't going right. They're not listening to the harbinger. They're joking. They're making fun of him. They're not heeding his warning. And they're just like, fuck you, Mordecai. Let's go, guys. All right. And then, and so like all the things that are usually happening to the cast of a horror movie, which would have been the kids, it's actually happening in reverse to the people that are creating this event.
Yeah, like they should be getting scared, or they should be getting worried, and they should be on edge, or, you know, it's...
Right,
it's,
so what you've been saying about Amy is that she's been warning them that, like, things have not been going well around the world. So now we're starting to understand this is a global thing happening. And they mentioned the Swedes have already failed, and now it's just down to them in Japan. Yeah. And, you know, they're laughing like, well, we know they're not going to fail. They always get it right. They have 100% success. Japan's got
100% clearance rate.
Yeah. So, like, they're not really worried that something's going to go wrong. And even if it does, they got their ass covered by Japan.
Yeah. And we got the betting scene, right?
So I love this scene.
This is, like, one of the best scenes, right? So they've got this big board up, and I think it really comes into focus as the story of the movie. So during the betting scene, you've got Gary and Steve explaining to the security guy really what's happening. And then the fact of, that they're going to be killed, right? But if they don't transgress, you know, they can't be punished. That they rig the game, they rig what's happening for this ritual. But at the end of the day, they sort of need to walk that final step on their own. And in this betting scene, you have all these departments from this facility, and we find out that they're betting on, like, monsters. So who is going to be the monster that these people pick, that they're going to actually meet their fate, meet their death, right?
Meet their doom. They go downstairs to the basement. There's all this weird stuff down there. Like, it's packed with stuff. Like, it looks like a hoarder's house, or like if you go to an antique shop, like when it's just like you have to like be careful not to knock things over when you walk through the aisles. Like, it's packed. And so she finally picks something up. What does she pick up? She picks up the diary. And
well, each of them picks something up. Kurt's got the conch. Jules has got the necklace. Holden, I think he's got the mask. I think he picks that up. And then Dana's got the book.
Yeah.
And they're all of them are about to initiate like connection with these items, blow the conch, put the necklace on, put the mask on their face. I think that's what it is. Or read the book. And then she's like, wait, read this. And then it goes on to talk about the history of the Buckners, the first owners. And she reads some disturbing information about how there was torture and abuse in the family. And then she's like, oh, there's some Latin here. Let's go ahead and read it.
And Marty's like, don't.
Marty's like, maybe this is not a good idea.
Do not read the Latin.
Read it. What the fuck?
And she's like not listening at all. Because anybody in their right mind, like anybody that spent time and just, you wouldn't be fucking reading the Latin anyway. So she reads the Latin.
I can't believe that's the thing you draw the line on. I would have never read that Latin.
Well, I don't know if I would have gone down to the basement anyways, like especially with all like the stuff just strewn about, right? It's like, anyways, she reads the Latin. And so that's going to set the wheels in motion.
Yeah, the Latin is like a.
It's a summons, right?
Yeah,
it's a summons.
It brings, and we have these cut scenes outside where we see hands coming out of the dirt and these zombies pull themselves out. And they're not just zombies, but they're a family of zombies from, you know, the turn of the century. Hillbilly zombies.
Yeah, zombie, redneck, you know,
right.
like butchers. And so that's so what we get now is, you know, we learn that each item is connected with a monster, a being, a zombie. And, you know, as we're learning in the film, that they have to summon their own kind of fate. They have to, again, the game is rigged, but they need to, you know, sort of step through that door. They need to do something that's going to seal their own fate. So they summon the zombies, right?
Well, we cut to the, back to the facility where like we see who won the,
yeah,
we see that exactly. Maintenance and the intern split the winnings because they put their money on redneck zombie family. And one girl's like, hey, I put my money on zombie too. Why didn't I win? He goes, there are two things here, zombie and zombie redneck family. They are distinctly different monsters.
Completely different species.
Yeah.
Completely different species, it says, right?
Yeah. So then Kurt and Jules go out to the woods to do it. And here's another part where they increase the pheromones from the mist from the ground. And like they're all waiting by the monitor, waiting for her to take her top off. They're like, oh, they're all twiddling their fingers and like jaws hanging open, waiting for this scene for her breast to come out.
But she doesn't want to right away. And then they're all watching there, and it does not happening. And I think there's a close up on Steve. And he's like, watch the master work. And he like, the lights come up, like the stage lights.
Yeah. If anybody's like, worked in television, in live television, that's totally what this is.
Yeah. And then like, he's got his hand on the controls and the pheromones come. Like and he's so proud of what he's doing. It's amazing. And then sure enough, she starts to like, she gets all randy. And
can you say it a little deeper this time?
She gets all randy.
Yeah.
And then it kicks off, right? And then it's like, it's fantastic. It's okay. Classic. So classic horror.
Here's where I want to throw some at you. You just said it. Classic horror, Jamie's favorite phrase. I want to throw some at you here, Jamie. At this point in the movie, I start to realize something. I mean, I've seen it before, but like this is where it really kicks into me. Once we've learned about
you've never had sex in the woods, or
we're not gonna talk about that on this pod. that at this point in the movie, I don't know if we've learned about the gods yet, that this is all about a sacrifice to these like old ancient gods that live in the earth and all that stuff. But what I really think the old ancient gods are like horror movie fans, because the whole idea of this is like they want to see blood. They want to see some boobs. They want to see this and that, this titillation. Like everything these people are, these people in the facility are doing is servicing what a horror movie usually wants to have. So in a way, these ancient gods are just basically horror nerds who are just like,
horror fans.
Yeah, that's what it is. The whole movie is in service to that kind of like, give me the boobs and give me the murder scene and give me the death scene. I want it now. Like that's my theory on this movie.
I like that. I think that's good. It's a good theory. It makes complete sense, right?
I think my theory is not that mind-blowing, by the way. Like the idea that the gods are the viewers, because this whole film is about – it's a takedown of the film – of the horror genre. So you can think about it as like, the gods are us, the viewers of horror who like horror movies. And then there's this crew who's trying to put on a horror movie for us, you know, and – I think that's like a pretty – like that's like the directors of the film. Like it's a pretty easy like connection there to like what it's about. And the one thing that kind of it's occurring to me right now is that like 2012 this came out. I think it's Marty says something like, you know, maybe humanity needs to go make room for something else.
Society needs to crumble. We're all just too chicken shit to let it.
Hey, man. Yeah, he says that. Humanity needs to crumble.
Yeah. And so like in a way – it's what he's talking about, the horror movie genre. Like it's time for us to like destroy this series of tropes, that whole, all this classic stuff that we love, because it's becoming so repetitive. Like this is just only a few years after Scream, right? Like, or 10 years after Scream, maybe. Like it's like the horror movie genre at this point is really running out of gas. In fact, if we look at the chronology, it's probably a kind of a blank spot for horror movies, right? I mean, that
well, depends on what you like. Pod, but, right? It's a whole other pod when you think about what you think about, you know, in the 2000s, what movie really kind of reinvigorated the horror genre. But that's a completely other.
But whichever one it was, like we don't have to say that here. But whichever one it was, it probably wasn't one that followed the formula that was so established in the 80s that this movie is clearly taking down. And so I think that's an interesting, like it's a self-critique of the genre that it's playing within. So like there's something very, very, very clever about that. So this is also where we get our first kill. We get a family emerges and, you know, a good villain should have a cool weapon. Well, this guy has like a bear trap on a chain and he's got long greasy hair like the Undertaker from WWE. And he can swing this chain around and somehow this bear trap can like open and like catch your back. And he can then pull, it gets into your skin and then he can drag you and pull you back with it. So he catches Jules and drags her away. And, you know, Thor tries to get up and take them on, but a couple more of them pop out of the woods. So he's got to like, he gets held back. And then they come out not just with, they have another tool, which is that old school, like how to chop down a tree saw, where one guy stands on one side.
Oh my God! Yeah,
on the handle, it's kind of like a.
It's kind of like two-handed.
It's kind of like an old shoemaker's tool. What do you call it?
A peloir.
A peloir. It kind of reminds me of a peloir, Jimmy, but it's longer. It's for cutting down trees. And they chop off Jules's head.
Okay, so. Her death is brutal, right? Like she gets stabbed in the hand when her hand is down there. Mm-hmm. And then she's got like the zombies around her. And the one scene where the saw passes in front of her face and you see just the eyes and how like, that's the classic scene. It's from Friday the 13th and has been used in other films as well. And then you just see them completely just decapitate her and, you know, that's a brutal killing. And the movie from this point on actually gets pretty gory. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of like a lot of gratuitous violence that you see. But after that happens, it's on. And Kurt, you know, he hauls ass into the cabin.
The weird thing is here, there's some decision here that I thought was strange. Kurt tells everyone to go to their own room and barricade their own room. And split up.
We're gonna lock this place down.
He's right.
We'll go room by room, barricade every window and door. We gotta play it safe. No matter what happens, we have to stay together.
What? What's the matter?
This isn't right. We should split up. We can cover more ground that way.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea.
Really?
But at first he says we got to stay together. But then they do something again with more of the chemicals in the room and just the whatever they're pumping into the air. And then he says, wait, no, we should split up. We can cover more ground. And then Marty goes, really?
Again, so they're just like the voice of reason who's too high for anyone to believe.
Yeah, so they all kind of just go into their own rooms and
then they're locked in. Like they're actually the people back at the lab hit the button and all the doors lock.
Yeah. Is this where Marty finds he knocks something over, right? Because he's, you know what he is?
He finds the camera.
He's by the window and then
Marty gets got. He gets dragged away. Then Dana is in her room. So Dana finds the hatch. It's in her room. Holden and her go down. They face Buckner again. Daddy Buckner like attacks with the bear claw. It is like another crazy battle because she like stabs him in the face, in the eye. She stabs him in the neck, like, and he does not die. And by zombie standards, he should have been dead, but like, keeps coming back. So we realize like these monsters are sort of beyond just what they are too. Like I don't think they ever go down.
And then they meet up with Kurt here, right?
And Kurt comes in and saves, like at the last minute, Kurt comes through.
Yeah. Kurt comes in and saves him and kind of pulls him out of there and then takes them to the RV. Yeah, that's right. So this is actually a really tense scene. So they're in the RV and they're going towards towards the tunnel. You know, and Rob, this is interesting too. This is like the first time that we've seen them panic on the facility, and because it's twofold. They've just seen that Japan has failed. Okay? They've seen that Japan has failed, that the children have been able to overpower the spirit.
They do like a song and they surround it. And the spirit is straight out of like The Ring, right? Like it looks like a Japanese horror movie is happening over there. And they're so pissed. Gary is pointing at the screen with the little kids.
Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you.
You seeing this?
Perfect record, huh?
The Japan crew should have had this in the bag. They fucked us. How hard is it to kill 9-year-olds?
Zero fatality.
Yeah, totally. Turns it into a frog. So they're already like a little bit freaked out. Then they see that they're heading for the tunnel. Well, if they get through the tunnel and they're able to get through or past that magnetic field, then the ritual is over because then they're out of their scope, right? So they're like fucking panicking. They're running around. The guy's going down to maintenance and there's like, oh, there's been an issue. There's been something which... you know, like it's not working, right? And clearly Gary is like, I guess he might have worked down there. It kind of alludes to the fact that that's where he might have started.
So
he pulls out the wires. He's like got red and blue together and he hits it together. And he's able just in the nick of time to get the cave to blow. So it impedes their ability to go on the road. Out, right? So all the stone comes down. So what they have to do is they have to back up because the whole cave is crumbling and collapsing.
So one thing about the tunnel, why did the tunnel not blow up? I don't remember this being answered later on. I remember them saying
No. So what they said is they went down to maintenance and they said, we don't know. There was some kind of glitch. There was something that was out of the ordinary. We don't know what it is. We can't trace it. So I have two theories on what that is.
Does the movie actually answer what happened?
No, we don't.
Because it happened really from above. He says, what do you mean someone from above? And then that's as much as we get. And I'm trying to figure out what does that mean?
Well, either it's from the director, mm-hmm. who we find out just in the last scene. Or I thought maybe because we see how Marty is able to, what he does for the story to kind of propel it into the final area there. Maybe he had done something with the wiring that had screwed things up. That's the only thing.
But Marty hasn't got down there yet.
No, but he's already been aware of that area. And when Dana comes down, he says, I think I can do it, which makes me think that he's already been fucking around with the wires. It's a stretch, but
no, but he's talking about the elevator. He's talking about how I think I can make the elevator go down.
Well, Rob, it's all connected with the wires, man. Maybe it's all.
Why would the elevator be connected to the bombs? Come on.
Dude, it's you're not an engineer. Like, there could be some kind of.
If that's the explanation, that is crazy town. That is not.
Anyway. Or, what would be the motivation for the director to sabotage the actual ritual?
Well, that's what makes me think could have happened, yeah. Except that in the final scene, she's doing everything she can to make it happen.
Exactly. So I'm not sure. So I thought the same thing, which drew me back to the elevator angle, which you don't like.
No, I don't understand how rewiring an elevator and he hasn't been down that deep into the facility yet to like go to maintenance, go down to the basement, like find the ones that how would he even know what he's doing? Anyway. So this is a scene where Thor decides he's going to do a little Johnny Blaze action here and jump the...
Blaze! Can you say trajectory? Oh, my God. That's a kid's joke. I can't believe I put that in.
Yeah, that's bad. He's going to jump the barge here. He's going to jump the chasm and go find help. But, of course, he leaps into the air, hits the magnetic web, you know, invisible wall. It just falls down really deep to the bottom of this chasm.
Kind of a brutal death, actually.
Yeah. Because which would have made it more impactful if we didn't know, because we know it's going to happen, right? Like,
I was trying to remember.
Or did you forget?
Well, that's the thing. I was trying to remember if I remembered that magnetic field was there, but I don't think I do. I don't think I did. I think that you're so caught up in the story at this point that when he goes and does it, it's such in hero mode. Like, you're expecting him to be able to kind of like go and make the jump and then bring it like just do something, bring authorities back. But the fact that it's just so stark and sudden that he just smashes in, you know, he's instantaneously dead and all hope is lost. Like, they're not getting out. There's something about that at this point in the movie, you don't feel like there's any other options for survival. That's what makes it so desperate, right?
Yeah, the music swells like right before he does the jump too, so you're sure he's going to do it. Also, when he hits, his body flips down so that you keep seeing the wall spark again several times. Yeah. You get a very clear sense that, yep, definitely invisible wall. It's all the way down. We're trapped here.
So Dana and Holden are left with no option. They need to go back and they need to find another way out. So one of the things is when they first got into the RV, there was a bit of foreshadowing there where they saw a handprint from the zombies. This is when Kurt was in there, when they were actually going to leave. Well, what happens? They're talking about, they have this little like conversation between the two of them about the situation. And yeah, exactly. Like, what are we going to do? And then out of the blue, classic horror. Rob, there it is again. Holden gets a fucking spear through the neck. And the RV scene, I'm gonna take this back to Friday. We actually did a Twitter Spaces on this, Rob. Friday the 13th, part 6, Tommy Jarvis court, where he's in the RV and he's had his girlfriend and like he's driving his RV and you know, he's kind of being silly. And he was actually a Travolta, by the way, but he gets killed from behind while he's driving. So that's what happens to Holden, right? He gets like literally a nasty spear through the neck with one of the zombies. And then what's actually one of the more tense scenes is because he was driving, it swerves off the road and it goes into
the lake. Yeah. And then she's got to escape. She's got to swim out of a
RV. So then you got the underwater. Sinking. And actually the camera work is really good here. You know, that's one of the things that we haven't, you know, talked about, right? Like the kind of the cinematography, because essentially it's like your standard classic stuff. But, you know, often in horror films, because of the budget, there's not a whole lot of underwater scenes. And some of the later Friday the 13th ones, there's some. But this actually has some underwater action scenes that are really good.
I actually thought they could have gone a little longer with when the zombie grabs her ankle, because you know what's going to happen. But at the same time, he only gets it for like half a second and she kicks loose. I thought they were going to hold that a little longer just so that you were a little more like, oh, maybe this is it. And she swims up to safety, or presumably safety. And meanwhile, back at the lab, they are popping bottles.
They're popping Modelo, man. They're friggin' drinking.
It's so strange. Actually brooding for this girl. She's got so much heart. You think of all the pain and the
tequila is my lady! My lady! Come on in, guys! Come on in! Come
Apparently,
on in.
It's okay that if one of them is allowed to get away, it has to be the virgin.
And then the phone rings.
Mm-hmm. And he knows, they know that the phone doesn't ring unless something is wrong. And so they so
yeah, exactly.
Turn the music off. Something's wrong.
Yeah, Marty's alive. It needs to go in order. And this is clearly not according to script, right? Like the Buckners have been, and it's funny, one of them will come back and play a little bit later on, but he gets them out of here. And what happens is they go into the elevator. He's able to get him out of the situation, and then they descend into, or the elevator starts descending. And the one thing that's kind of cool is different to other elevators is this one moves vertically and it moves horizontally. And this is where, like, do you remember when you watched this movie for the first time, what you were thinking when you got to this, mm-hmm. when you got to this point, you're like, okay, so what are we going to see here? I remember that's what I was thinking, because from the betting scene and then just from the whole story of the movie and the ritual and the fact that there's all those different monsters and species out there that can kill you.
I didn't put that together that quickly though in my head. Like I thought, oh, they've found their way into the lab and they're going to sneak in and you know, surprise everyone at the party kind of thing. But you're right. They came up where the monsters are sent in, and therefore as they go down,
yeah,
they essentially go down to this archive of monsters, and every different cube, these glass cubes, holds a different monster. And so as they move around, they start encountering them through the glass. They can't be hurt, but you know, they get face to face with some pretty nasty looking creatures. They see the werewolf. They see the guy like who's totally like a Hellraiser.
Oh yeah,
he's a Cenobite. Kind of looks like one of those guys, right? Like
Sure. In fact, a lot of the species, a lot of these like demons are taken from other horror films. And
yeah, I think they're homages. I don't think there's any that
No, they're not. They're not exactly, because you couldn't do that, right? But they were absolutely homages, right? Like the one Fornicus, Lord of the, you know, that's absolutely from, because he's holding that metal ball in his hand. That's absolutely from Hellraiser. So they get through, they eventually get down to, I guess, like the lobby. Okay. So they're kind of like totally freaked out. And this one thing, they're going through these like containment cubes, or looking at all these different things, and they're like scared shitless. Right. So then they have a security guard when they actually come to the main lobby that greets them, because clearly they need to be killed. But it's funny, like the zombie hand of who Marty killed grabs his hand.
That's a great gimmick.
Yeah. Really good. Right. Like Evil Dead kind of stuff. Here's the thing I didn't understand, right? So this is a complete breach, and now like all the security is after them, assuming that they need to kill Marty right away. And then I'm not sure what they're going to do, but it looks like they're shooting to kill. They're able to get into like the control booth. And Rob, did you not find it a little strange that the full system purge to release every monster in this fucking whole facility is one, it's like in one, it's like low level, like the
it's like
the,
a parking lot security,
like,
booth.
Like the janitor would be able to get in there. Like, it's like, you know what I mean? And then all you do is you flip up like one switch and then you hit a red button. To me, that's like, it's a lot of red flags there. A lot of red flags. I don't know.
Seems like their security is not as tight as you might think it would be.
Oh my God,
plus
no.
It opens all the doors at the same time.
Let's get this party started.
No, it's literally down at the elevators. It's one door. I see Marty, he walks in, he locks it, and then they're able to do a full system purge on this, right? And that's like, essentially, what's there to say at the end? You know, from this point on in the film. Okay.
Well, here's something I'll tell you. Going back to my theory that these two are the monster of the movie. Like the victims of this movie are not the kids in the cabin. It's the people in the lab, and they have underestimated the monster over and over again. And here's where the monster, these two kids, finally unleash their full power and just like kill everybody.
Oh my God. When they, for sure, when they release these monsters, like, it's a great scene, eh? When all the security, the SWAT team guys are in the elevator lobby and all the monsters come out, like the snake and like the, it's like crazy, the ghost, and they just kill them right away. It's like so much blood. There's so much gore. They unleash the werewolf comes out. Like, it's ridiculous. But it's payback for them for being put in that situation. You know what I mean?
And that's it too, right? In a horror movie, usually deaths aren't kind of earned. Like, you make a mistake or you do something dumb or you're an asshole or whatever. And so this is exactly what's happening here, is that the lab is getting their just desserts, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. The scenes continue as Marty and Dana are kind of making their way through the facility, and there's more and more of these creatures, these species that are unleashed. And then it reminds me of, like, from Event Horizon with, like, the visions from hell where they saw, you know what I mean? Like, they see, like, the log monitors of, like, all.
Yeah.
And, but then here you see like the monitors of all these species doing, like, the most, like, just heinous stuff.
Horrible shit.
Horrible stuff. Like, horrible. Like, just. And then you've got workers, like, that are killing themselves, and I don't know, it's just torture all over the facility from these things, right? So they're basically just coming back and just getting payback on all these despicable people that are, this is what they,
well, they
do
still think, because remember, these monsters are only the tip of the iceberg, right? The ancient ones, yeah, the ancient gods that are below the earth are the ones that they need to
please,
down
otherwise
there.
There's going
to
be,
and they had to please them. This is like the Hail Mary now, right? They just got to get it done one way or the other.
You know, Dana and Marty, they eventually jump through the hole in the corridor and they make their way down first. But then just before that happens, we see the death of Steve, and Steve's death is a hilarious death because he's always, as we found out, he's always bet on the merman. He always wanted to see the merman in action. And of course it was fitting that he's on the floor and the merman is coming crawling towards him.
Yeah,
and then
he just goes, you can't run.
He goes,
oh, come on.
And the merman just comes and just starts chomping on him and spewing
the blood shoot out his blowhole.
Oh my God. Like, it's
that's just such a good touch.
Exactly. It's disgusting.
They run into Gary and they accidentally kill him. It's just an accident around the corner. But the last thing he says to her, to Dana, he whispers to her, I don't think Marty actually hears it, is kill him, kill him. Like, so it's put in her head now that, like, wait a minute, this whole thing is still around this. Like, why are they so concerned? Right.
Yeah.
Why do they want his dead so bad? And that's when they get to the ritual room, they see the blood pouring through those sculptures, and they start to realize, like, oh, we are each one of these people. We represent one of these figures, the athlete, the academic. And Sigourney Weaver enters the movie as the director, and she explains the whole ritual and why it's important that they complete it. And there's only a little bit of time before the sun comes up, and if they don't get it done, these ancient gods who live under the earth are going to come up and destroy all of them. And apparently everyone's going to have a very painful death too. She makes sure she mentions that. I'm not sure how they would know that, but anyway.
Going back to Bradley Whitford's character, where he said, you know, it used to be so easy. Like, you know, we would just throw a girl into a volcano and then the sacrifice would be done. But over time, the ancient ones have wanted more. They've wanted more elaborate rituals in order to suffice there, in order to kind of meet the sacrifice. And that's kind of, I guess, where we land today.
That speaks to my horror film theory that the gods are just horror film fans.
Always wanting more?
Yeah, like, it's like the violence is increasing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the ritual of this watching people get killed on camera has become more and more, like, baroque.
So you've got a fight between Sigourney Weaver, you've got a fight between Marty and Dana, and she needs to get him killed ASAP. And then they'll just let the gods decide. But of course, in absolutely fitting fashion, who has made their way from the containment, not even containment cubes, from the cabin in the woods, through the elevator, through the facility, down to the lower chambers, the lower tombs, and raises an axe and descends that axe upon Sigourney Weaver's head. But the Buckner daughter, who Dana had read about earlier, much earlier on in the movie, as the one who was tortured and the one that lost her arm from her father's abuse. So she's the one, she's an interesting character. It's like, is she the hero or the anti-hero? I don't know what she was, but she certainly plays the hero at this, you know, almost doing him a solid to kill Sigourney Weaver. And then she falls down into like the pits of hell. And then you're left with Dana and Marty sitting there on the steps.
Smoking a blunt.
Understanding that like impending doom is about to happen, and then the fucking building starts to collapse, and then the movie ends with a.
Actually, before it ends, there's one thing I love, and again, my theory. I love that Marty says,
"Giant evil gods."
I wish I could have seen it.
I know. That would have been a fun weekend.
Because, like, that's the thing with the whole movie. Like, at the end, you see an arm, but you never really get to see them, right?
Yeah.
And I love that.
See them without the mask. You never see the face, right? It's a lot of innuendo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's very typical of like a horror movie. You don't quite get to see something. Usually it's like Jason's face, or it's like you don't get to see the thing that you kind of wanted to see. Sometimes you don't show you the good kill or whatever it is. But I just love that line is there at the end. Like, yeah, I wish I got to see them. It's just it's a funny little bow tie in the whole movie.
So what do you think, Rob? What do you think of this film? How would you rate this film?
What am I going to – so The Cabin in the Woods, how would I rate this film? It's a tough one for me, James, because it is a comedy horror. Like, it's comedy.
Is it funny?
Yeah, it's funny. I find it funny.
Yeah,
I find it pretty funny.
I did find
it. Way funnier than Krampus, I'll tell you. I laughed way more times during this than that.
Krampus.
So I think it succeeds at being what it's supposed to be. I do have a lot of fun seeing, like, the subversions of the genre, all the – homages to the monsters from, you know, famous horror. Even the idea of the whole structure of the film, the way it is, like as a sort of tear, like a takedown of the horror genre, like, oh, this is, you know, like the structure of the horror movie being played out in front of you. But at the same time, it keeps flipping on itself. And in fact, in a lot of ways, the characters are not who they seem to be. Like the most evil characters, which seem to be the people at the lab, are in fact, by the end of it, going to be the victims who, you know, everything bad will happen to them. They're the ones that get hunted by the end. So I enjoy that this movie keeps you guessing and keeps flipping the expectations up and down. Am I scared? I don't get scared by it, but in a comedy horror, are you ever actually scared in a comedy horror?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this movie deserves a lot of praise for like pulling off the like trick that it did. And it's kind of like an ambitious idea that they're trying to pull off. And it really lends itself to fans of like superheroes or like, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, TV show, where like they can really like blow things out on a camp level, like this, like, terrible, horrible things can be blown up into like really kind of super heroic or like campy level where it's cheesy, but it, like, you know, it's cheesy. So you just kind of, you get to enjoy it. It's kind of like eating something with way too much sugar. Like you get to enjoy that bite. Is it a genius film? I don't know. It's pretty smart.
Yeah. I actually think it's a very smart film. I think, you know, the trick that it pulls off, it totally has you thinking one thing and moves in another direction and is really clever. And it's just conceptually fresh. It was a horror comedy film, but had such a fresh idea, you know, like of a central sort of conspiracy government facility working against its people to trying to get them to do things that they don't want to do. Like this is, you know, I'm not saying it is the Hunger Games, but I don't know. I pull a lot of stuff from The Cabin in the Woods to The Hunger Games, even just some of the pieces and some of the ideas. I remember watching it and thinking, fuck, man, that was like really cool and interesting and hadn't been done before. Mm-hmm. So in terms of just like a freshness, you get high marks. I actually think the performances are really good. I think Marty's good. I think he's one of the better actors in the film. I think Gary and Steve are great. And we talked about that at the beginning. I think those guys mm-hmm. do such a good job. And of course, it's playing with the horror tropes and subversion of them and how the characters all kind of interact and who goes and who should die in a classic horror film and who doesn't here and how they have to turn it around. I love the personal killings in the beginning and then the gore and the blood count was like up to, I think I saw online, there was like 68 or 69 kills in this film. And also, fuck man, just seeing all the monsters is cool. Like, mm-hmm. like,
yeah, it's fun. It's just, and it's kind of fun to kind of watch the monitors try to pick out who they are, what they're referencing.
Just like all these different things that you would see from paranormal, all the subgenre of horror has been put into this film, but in a cool and accessible way, in a way that makes sense, smart way. I think this is, for me, this is a 4 out of 5 footsteps. I think it's a really good movie.
It's a lot of fun. So I would also give it 4 footsteps.
Nice.
Yeah.
We agree again. Yeah,
I agree. I couldn't go lower. I can't go all the way to 5, but I think this is one I'd easily recommend. No problem.
No, man. It's not a five. It's not a 5. Like it's the idea is clever. Okay.
I'm wondering if we should go higher because it's a comedy. You got to keep remembering that they are being funny.
And no, like, I'm sticking. It's 4 out of 5. That's a good score. You know what I mean? It's a horror comedy. It's funny. It's clever. It's witty. I like the writing in it. I think Marty's character was like written really well, and just the way he delivered. I actually thought his performance. He's like the star of the. Him and Gary and Steve are the best. They have the best acting performances, right? They deliver the best. They deliver the most. And you see a good arc with those characters.
I agree with you said before. The cast is good too. Like when you go deeper though, like no one is bad in this film. Jules is good. Dana's good.
No, nobody's bad. There's no like bad. Like if you watch you watch.
Well, any of the old horrors, there's always often.
Any of the old horrors, like they're bad. They're bad. Like they can't even deliver a line. You know, and this cast can, and it never felt cheap in a way. It felt the production level was high. It was a high budget. It was directed well. Like again, and then the one scene in the water, like there was a nice little piece of cinematography there. Like it had like little pieces of like really quality filmmaking, which when you sprinkle that and mix that with what is just a really fresh idea, it is like, you know, the ritual, the sacrificial lamb film, but done in like a satirical way. It's great. Like it's,
and like you're saying, you always say the runtime. I don't know why you always make sure people know how long it is, but in a way it's a compliment that they hit the 90 minute mark and like, it's well edited. It's like the movie.
That's actually another good point. You know what? There's not like they trim the fat, eh? There's not a lot of waste in here.
Mm-hmm.
Like every scene's got a purpose. I'm sure I would love to see like a director's cut of this and see if, you know, if they had an extra 30 minutes, you know, 20, 30 minutes where that is, right? Because when you think about it, there's not a lot of time spent in the cabin. Like they go there and then they're there. And then they have the final scene. You're really like left with 3 sections, right?
Mm-hmm.
The journey, the time there, and then the time in the facility, which they're in the facility for like a half an hour at the end of the film. So it moves. It moves. Anyways.
Good stuff. Speaking of moving, we're going to get you moving with our next Jogcast coming out real soon. That is Blood at Night, Part 3. We'll have all 3 parts glued together for probably about a 50-minute jog. Is it more epic than Helen Hamilton Part 3, Jamie? I don't know. We'll find out when we hear it, I guess. It's pretty crazy.
I think it's pretty crazy, man. You know what? And one of the things I want to recommend everybody out there right now is that when you get down to this Jogcast, I want you to go out to your local tech shop and pick up the Ghost Pacer. Rob, have you heard about the Ghost Pacer?
Yeah, I told you about the Ghost Pacer. We don't endorse. We are not doing a promo here. We have no idea who these people are, but this thing looks kind of cool. That's why we're bringing it up.
So essentially what it is like this, I think it's 85 like milligrams, and it's a glasses headset that you put on, and then you have a Ghost Pacer. So my guess is you can set like a pace going around a track, and you have a fucking hologram that you're looking in front of you that sets the pace. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's like, AR technology, and like if you're into all that metaverse stuff that's starting to blow up these days, this idea of an AR jogging buddy is kind of what it is. It's kind of cool that like you could try to like outpace and beat this hologram, this AR hologram. I think down the road, Jamie, we combine this with the Jogcast and those holograms are chasing you to murder you. That's where the technology is going.
Oh, fuck yeah. Exactly. That's where we're going, people. Rob and I are going into the metaverse with our podcast, which is really a Jogcast, which is really a metaverse cast. So we are excited, and we'll see you in 25 years. Thank you for listening. Again, send us a message at therunningscaredpod@gmail.com. If you want to follow us at Twitter, you can find us at runningscaredpd. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can find us at runningscaredpod. If you want to support us, we can always use a couple of extra bucks to help us produce and edit these Jogcasts and specialty episodes and reviews. You can find us on Patreon. We've got a lot of exciting things planned for 2022. We are not going anywhere. We hope you aren't either. We're excited to provide content for you. We love doing it. Send us an email. Shout us out. Send us a message. And we will see you next time on Running Scared.
The Running Scared podcast is written and produced by Jamie Roberts and Robert Lendrum. Edited by Robert Lendrum. With original music by Jamie Roberts. Keep an eye out for future episodes wherever you download your podcasts, and we'll see you next time on Running Scared.
Oh my God. I'm on a reality TV show. My parents are gonna think I'm such a burnout.